Welcome to the Deep Dive, Time Magazine, September 8th, 2025.
That's our focus today.
Exactly. I'm Andy Byron, and it's great to have you with us. Our goal here, like always, is to give you that shortcut, that deep understanding of a really important piece of journalism.
We want to help you get informed quickly, cut through all the noise.
And today, yeah, we are diving into Time Magazine's September 8th, 2025 issue. Specifically, their big feature on a name you've probably been hearing a lot about.
Zoran Mamdani.
Zoran Mamdani. It's a story that's not just, you know, making waves. It feels like it's actively reshaping things.
I'm Chris Cabot. My job here is to help us synthesize all this info, connect the dots, really.
Mm-hmm.
Look beyond just the headlines in the article and think about the broader context, the implications. We want you to understand not just what's happening with Mamdani in NYC politics.
But why it matters.
Exactly. Why it matters beyond the city and maybe get you thinking critically about what it all signifies for, well, for the future.
Absolutely. So our mission today, unpack this Time feature. It's all about Zoran Mamdani's, frankly, dramatic rise. Almost overnight, it seems, he's become the likely next mayor of New York City.
It's quite the story.
It really is. We're going to walk you through his, let's call it unconventional political path. We'll look at his policies, the specific things he's proposing.
And the controversies, too, which are definitely there.
Oh, yeah. Impossible to ignore those. And ultimately, what is his potential mayoralty mean? For New York, of course, but also, crucially, for the National Democratic Party.
Because the ripples go far beyond the five boroughs.
They really do. So yeah. It's all about pulling out the key insights, the really important nuggets from this detailed Time report. And there's a lot to dig into here.
Okay, let's get started.
So New York City, it has this way of creating stars, right? But the Time piece suggests this thing with Zoran Mamdani feels, well, different, faster, maybe more intense.
It really captures that intensity.
Yeah, they describe these scenes, like him just walking down Fifth Avenue after a union meeting. And within a block, boom, a crowd forms.
Phones out, following him.
Like a rock star, yeah. It's quite something to read about the scale of it. People blurting out, oh my God, hello,
mm-hmm.
Clapping, cars honking.
Traffic stopping, a plumber jumping out of his van.
Literally. Traffic comes to a standstill because a plumber wants to shake his hand. The article calls it star treatment. And it's happening in multiple languages across generations. It's broad.
But not universally positive.
No, definitely not. The flip side is there, too. The article mentions the xenophobic death threats. Serious enough that he now needs an entourage, security, you know, guys with earpieces.
Which really underscores how quickly and dramatically his profile shifted from relative unknown to this.
Almost instant polarization.
Well, that's what's truly remarkable, isn't it? And maybe a key insight from Time here is just the sheer acceleration. How fast political celebrity can happen now, especially in the digital age.
He was basically unknown before 2025, right?
Practically a cipher, as the article puts it. And then, you know, just a few months later, he's this huge figure, a lightning rod nationally.
You see the adoration, the crowds, the multilingual support.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty striking for someone who was just a state assemblyman.
Unprecedented, almost.
Yeah.
But then, right alongside it, you get the hecklers shouting anti-Semitic. That stark contrast, that extreme polarization. It's incredibly significant.
It reflects the divides he taps into, or maybe creates.
Both, perhaps. He certainly embodies them and maybe amplifies them. It's not just a New York story in that sense. It really shows how figures can just explode onto the scene now.
Manufactured almost by social media and the political climate.
For better or worse, yeah. Becoming instant focal points for, well, both intense love and intense hate.
And it's just wild when you think about the timeline. He's 33 years old, started as a Democratic Socialist, a, let's be honest, backbench state assemblyman.
Not exactly the traditional path to Gracie Mansion.
Not at all. And Time highlights this incredible leap from local long shot, and he really was, to suddenly being the likely mayor of America's biggest city.
And it went national so fast.
Instantly. He became, as they put it, a main character in national politics. Suddenly he's all over cable news. Everyone's debating him left and right.
Even senior Democrats felt they had to weigh in.
Yeah, which is unusual, right? They're usually more cautious. But they were publicly discussing whether to support him or oppose him. And then you get the really dark stuff.
The attacks from Trump.
Yeah, the article mentions former President Trump pushing what it calls a dark new birtherism, questioning Mamdani's immigration status.
Even though he's a U.S. citizen.
Right. Born Uganda, became a citizen back in 2018. Trump even floated the idea of having him arrested. It's pretty grim.
And connecting this to the bigger picture, You know, Hamdani's rise isn't just this fascinating New York narrative. It really could signal a pretty profound shift happening within the Democratic Party nationally.
Because of his politics, his background.
All of it. His unapologetically progressive stance, the speed of his ascent, the way he activates both supporters and opponents. It forces a conversation about the party's identity, its direction.
And the reaction from figures like Trump.
Well, that just highlights the incredibly high stakes, doesn't it? And the intensely politicized climate he's navigating. Plus, you can't overlook the historical significance time points out.
First South Asian, first Muslim mayor.
If he wins, yes. That's a landmark in itself. And it resonates far beyond New York. That speaks to changing demographics, changing political aspirations across the country.
So it's this mix of things, progressive ideas, his background, the speed, his identity, that makes him such a, well, potent figure.
Exactly. Potent and polarizing.
And at the heart of his pitch, or at least his philosophy, is this idea he talks about, a politics of no translation.
What does he mean by that exactly?
Well, he frames it as breaking down barriers, being a bridge between politicians and regular people. He said in an interview, the most important thing is that people see themselves and their struggles in your campaign.
So making policy relatable.
Right. He wants a politics that is direct, a politics that when you read the policy commitment, you understand it as how it applies to your life. No jargon, no bureaucracy, just here's the problem, here's how this helps you.
Okay, so the insight there, I think, is that in this really polarized, often confusing political world we live in, full of jargon.
Yeah, it's overwhelming.
Right. So this politics of no translation, it kind of cuts through all that noise by being radically accessible. It's almost subversive in a way.
How so?
Well, think about it. In an era of complex laws, political speak, abstract debates, just being direct is revolutionary. It disarms the usual gatekeepers, maybe builds trust faster, especially with people who feel ignored by traditional politics.
It offers clarity, a connection.
Exactly. It challenges that whole idea that policy has to be discussed in some specialized, inaccessible language. Now you could ask, does it risk oversimplifying things?
Sure, complex problems often need complex solutions.
Of course. But there's no doubt it can boost engagement and trust, especially as people feel like, okay, he gets my life, he gets my struggles. It gives them a stronger sense of ownership in the whole process.
Okay, so how did he pull this off? The article really gets into the mechanics of the campaign. And it sounds like, well, a masterclass.
Starting from single digits, remember.
Exactly. The total long shot. Mm. But then in the June Democratic primary, he just executed brilliantly. Time details, these really innovative methods. Viral videos got his name out there initially.
Not just standard ads.
No, different stuff. And then these cross-borough walkabouts, going into all sorts of neighborhoods, conservative areas, immigrant communities, mosques, really covering the ground.
And what was the message on those walks?
Super clear, super direct policy pitches, free buses, a rent freeze for regulated units, that's a million apartments, and universal childcare.
Wow. Big, tangible promises.
Very focused, very grounded, hitting issues that, you know, deeply affect everyday New Yorkers' wallets and lives.
And the effectiveness of that approach, the grassroots combined with digital, against a more traditional campaign, it's really striking. It's almost a blueprint.
Especially against Cuomo.
Right. The contrast is huge. Cuomo's campaign is described as grim and joyless, relied on the old playbook. Name recognition, TV ads, established labor ties.
And a ton of money.
A ton of money. Over $20 million in super PAC spending backing him. Remember, those are the outside groups that can spend unlimited amounts.
So that financial muscle was all on Cuomo's side.
Which makes Mamdani's win, fueled by small dollars and volunteers, even more remarkable in a local primary. His approach, one opponent's advisor called him one of the best political athletes I've ever seen play the game.
High praise from an opponent.
It suggests he just leveraged direct engagement and social media in a way that outmaneuvered the old guard. It's about authenticity, communication, having a story people connect with in this new media world.
But it wasn't just digital, was it? The ground game sounds immense.
Oh, absolutely critical. He built, as the article calls it, an army of 50,000 volunteers. 50,000.
That's incredible. What did they do?
They knocked on 1.6 million doors across the city. Just think about that number. 1.6 million conversations.
Wow. That speaks volumes about his ability to build that broad multicultural coalition reaching into every corner.
It does. And then there's his stance on the Israel-Gaza conflict.
Yeah, that was surprising to many. He refused to back down from criticizing Israel's war in Gaza.
Even in New York City, with the largest Jewish community outside Israel, many thought that would be political suicide.
Right. It makes his success seem even more improbable.
Well, what's fascinating there is the strategy, the risk versus reward. Taking that firm, often unpopular stance, it absolutely could have alienated a crucial group of voters.
But it didn't sink him.
No. And maybe, just maybe, it actually helped him with his base. It could have cemented his image as, principled, sincere, someone who wouldn't compromise core beliefs, even if it hurt politically.
So for some voters, that conviction was appealing.
Potentially, yes. Especially for voters tired of politicians who seem to shift with the wind. For that segment, maybe particularly younger progressives, that stance could have been a powerful draw, even while it clearly turned others away. It's a different kind of political calculation.
Prioritizing consistency, maybe.
Perhaps a calculated gamble that in his specific race clearly worked.
And beyond the policy and the ground game, there was this element of, well, the article calls it vibes, and his digital skill.
Tell me more about the vibes.
Well, remember that snappy Trump voter video? That went viral. Then others, like him talking about halalflation, inflation hitting halal food carts with street vendors.
Okay, connecting with specific communities.
Yeah, and then there was the stunt where he jumped into the freezing ocean off Coney Island in winter to symbolize freezing the rent.
Huh. Memorable, certainly.
Right. He seemed intent on having fun, making it engaging, a real contrast to what felt like a lot of doom and gloom in the Democratic Party at the time.
Injecting some energy.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And he credits his wife, Rama Dewaji, for teaching him how to use social media better. Shows he's willing to learn, adapt.
That's interesting.
And it worked. There was this surprising early momentum. Even new volunteers enjoyed canvassing because, as the article quotes one saying, talking about affordability really resonates. The message hit home.
This idea of a virtuously reinforcing cycle of vibes, field, and message, that phrase from the article really captures it, I think.
How so? What does that mean?
It means his strategic use of, cultural moments, digital platforms. It let his personality and his direct message amplify his policies. It wasn't just surface level stuff.
He created energy.
Yeah, it's an energetic, relatable story that inspired people to act and that attracted celebrity support, Alison Roman, Emily Ratajkowski are mentioned, which brought more attention,
More volunteer.
more door knocking, all focused back on those core economic issues. It's just a clear example of how campaigns are changing.
Personality matters more. Authenticity.
They can be just as impactful, maybe more so, than traditional ads and old political machines, especially when you can create that compelling, shareable story online. The vibe isn't just fluff, it's a tool for mobilization, especially when tied to a strong field operation and a resonant message.
To really get Mom Donnie, though, you kind of have to look at where he comes from. His background is pretty unique, not your typical political origin
Moves
story.
across continents, right?
Yeah, Uganda, South Africa, New York. And his parents are very public figures. His father, Mahmoud Mamdani, is this renowned scholar of post-colonialism.
Now at Columbia, important field, critiquing colonialism's lasting impacts.
Right. And his mother, Mirren Ayer, the filmmaker, Academy Award nominee, directed big names.
So a very globally aware, intellectually stimulating household.
Definitely. The article calls it a showbiz family, and it seems like he got this interesting mix of influences from his dad, a very deep commitment to social justice, that intellectual rigor,
And from his mom.
an incredible energy, according to the article, and a fine aesthetic sense, a feel for storytelling, presentation. You can kind of see how that might translate to politics.
Stage presence, maybe?
Yeah, it probably contributed to his stage presence. He even had an amateur rapping career. And he worked on music for his mom's film, Queen of Katwe, got celebrities like Madhur Jaffery and Lupita Nyong'o in his music videos.
So a childhood steeped in both serious ideas and creative expression definitely prepares you for the public eye.
You'd think so.
And connecting that to the bigger picture, that really unconventional upbringing must have shaped his political identity, how he communicates.
In what way?
Well, growing up across cultures, in a family deeply engaged with social commentary, public art, it would naturally give you a broader perspective,
Yeah.
right? Make you comfortable expressing yourself publicly.
He talked about straddling the city's divides.
Exactly. And look at his education. He went to the progressive Bank Street School, very child-centered, egalitarian. They mentioned gym contests ending in ties.
Controversial ties.
Ah, right. And then he goes to the super competitive, academically intense Bronx Science High School. That range of experiences.
From one extreme to the other, almost.
It likely helped him connect with different kinds of people, understand different viewpoints, made him adaptable. That's a key skill for leading a place as complex as New York City.
So where did the specific politics come from? The activism?
While Time traces his political education through progressive activism. Started pretty early, co-founded a Students for Justice in Palestine chapter back at Bowdoin College in Maine.
That's a group critical of Israeli policies focused on Palestinian rights.
Right. After college, he did some organizing, some music, worked on a few losing campaigns for left-leaning candidates in the city.
Yeah.
Got his feet wet.
But the key formative experience seems to be later.
Yes. That year or so, he spent as a foreclosure prevention counselor, working at Chaya Community Development Corporation in Queens.
Helping people facing foreclosure.
Exactly. The executive director there remembered him as creative, committed, bringing this very positive can-do energy to a really tough job, helping vulnerable people navigate the system, try to stay in their homes.
That sounds like it would have a real impact on you.
Absolutely. And that direct experience clearly shaped his later focus on housing as a human right. It became a core part of his platform.
Rounded in real-world experience.
For sure. It's clear how those early experiences built the foundation for his politics, what the article calls principled pocketbook focused.
Principled and practical.
Yeah, because what's fascinating is how that direct work, seeing people's struggles up close, it wasn't just theory from a book, it was lived reality. Seeing how economic policies, housing instability, just devastated real families.
That would make you impatient with the system.
Exactly. It fueled his impatience with traditional politics, which can feel so slow, so disconnected from urgent needs. So that background, it really gives context for his later actions, his commitment to policies tackling basic economic security, like housing. It grounds his ideals in something concrete, human, and that resonates.
Okay, so he gets elected to the State Assembly, arrives in Albany in 2021. This is right after the big racial justice protest, deep in the pandemic activism wave.
Riding that wave, in a sense.
Yeah. But Albany, it's a different world. The article highlights the challenges he faced just starting out, calls it a place of an asymmetry of information.
Meaning the old hands know how things really work.
Exactly. Power lies with those who've been there, know the unwritten rules, the process. Even just figuring out how to file legislation was a learning curve for him and his chief of staff, L. Bisgard Church.
Steep learning curve, I imagine.
Sounds like it. But his commitment was clear from the start. He put Bisgard Church through four interviews, including one with reps from the NYC Democratic Socialists of America.
So aligning himself clearly with that movement from day one.
Yeah, showing he wasn't just there to blend in. He wanted to bring a specific ideology, a new approach, right into the Capitol.
And that impatience with the nature of politics as it was, it showed up pretty quickly, didn't it?
Oh, yeah. That sleepout incident in the Capitol's war room in April 2021, that was quite a statement.
He and other young lawmakers camped out.
Yep. Sleeping bags, even a tent, apparently. Pushing for higher taxes on the wealthy, housing relief. It was pure direct action right inside the halls of power.
A signal he wanted to disrupt the usual way things are done.
Totally. A very visible way to say, we need to break out of how these issues are discussed behind closed doors.
Hmm.
Trying to connect the debate to how it's actually felt by New Yorkers.
So using protest and public pressure early on.
Definitely. And that wasn't even the most dramatic protest. Later that year, the hunger strike.
The 15-day hunger strike for the taxi drivers.
Right. Supporting drivers crushed by debt from those expensive medallions. Bharavi Desai from the Taxi Workers Alliance said Mamdani treated us as equals, helped connect them with big players like Chuck Schumer.
And it led to a deal.
It did. A successful city-backed relief deal. A huge win.
Mm.
But the commitment. The article mentions him leaving the protest in a wheelchair after 2 weeks without food. Shows how far he was willing to go.
That's intense dedication.
Beyond that, he also launched the Fix the MTA campaign with State Senator Michael Gianaris.
Tackling transit issues, always popular in NYC.
Oh, yeah. Advocating for frozen fares, free city buses, better subway service. They use slick websites, relatable videos trying to mobilize public support around commuter frustrations.
So, again, that mix of tactics. Protest, inside negotiation, public campaigns.
Right. What's interesting here is that combination, the inside-outside game he played.
The hunger strike is pure outside pressure, right?
Yeah.
High-stakes protest aiming to force action.
But then he's liaising with Schumer, working within the system too.
Exactly. And the Fix the MTA campaign is similar. Partnering with Senator Gianaris, using digital tools to build support. It actually led to a pilot program for one free bus route per borough in 2023.
So it worked to a degree.
A modest but tangible victory, as Time calls it, concrete progress. It showed his pressure could yield results. But
there's always a but.
Well, the article notes it also showed the limits to what you can achieve outside the real negotiating rooms, because that pilot program wasn't renewed or expanded. So public pressure isn't everything. It suggests that while it's great for raising awareness and building support, getting big, costly changes actually implemented often still comes down to traditional negotiation and getting buy-in from other powerful players.
Which brings us to that incident with the state budget. The perfect is the enemy of the good lesson.
Right. Tell me about that again.
The article reports Mamdani complained directly to the assembly speaker, Carl Heasy, about a budget provision he thought would raise rents. He ended up casting a symbolic no vote on the whole budget bill.
Which is a bold move for a freshman.
Very. And then, maybe coincidentally, maybe not, that free bus pilot program he'd fought for vanished from later budgets.
Ouch. Punishment.
Heasty and Mamdani both deny it was punishment. And the State Transit Authority apparently wasn't thrilled with the cost of the pilot anyway. But the timing, the optics, it certainly looks like his rigid stance might have had consequences.
It does raise that important question, doesn't it? How did that experience shape his approach to compromise, his understanding of Albany realpolitik?
Did he learn the lesson?
Well, Speaker Heasty's observation that Mamdani learned that you can't always let the perfect be the enemy of the good. That's a pretty telling insight. It suggests a realization that in the real world of policymaking,
you sometimes have to take what you can get.
Exactly. Incremental progress, strategic compromise, they're often necessary to get anything done for your constituents. Holding out for the perfect ideal, however principled, can mean ending up with nothing.
So did his approach change after that?
The article points to him voting for the entire budget this year as a possible sign of that pragmatic evolution. A shift, maybe, from pure protest to understanding the need for some give and take to advance his bigger goals, even if parts aren't perfect.
That kind of pragmatism would be pretty crucial for a mayor.
Absolutely essential for governing effectively in a place like New York City Hall.
Okay, fast forward. Just days after Trump wins his second term in November, Mamdani launches what Time calls his Don't Worry Tour. Sounds like damage control almost.
Or maybe reassurance. Who is he trying to reassure?
The establishment, basically. Big business, maybe moderate Democrats. There was this high-profile meeting, 150 CEOs, top business leaders at Rockefeller Center.
Wow, stepping right into the lion's den in a way?
You could say that because the context is key. Time says there was real concern, even alarm, among NYC power brokers, national Democrats. Some vowed to stop him. Others just doubted he could manage the city, 300,000 employees, huge budget.
Serious doubts about his readiness.
Big time. So Mamdani goes to this meeting, he shows up, wears a suit, listens, reassures them, promises to be a mayor for everyone who calls this city home.
Projecting responsibility, inclusivity.
A very deliberate effort to calm those nerves, present himself as competent, maybe less radical than they feared.
And how did he handle the really tough questions? Particularly that globalized the Intifada controversy. That must have come up.
Oh, for sure. And Time notes how he navigated that intense scrutiny. It recaps the whole thing. His initial reluctance on a podcast to outright condemn the phrase.
Saying he didn't use it, but didn't want to ban words.
Right, which drew fire from people like Rahm Emanuel, Josh Shapiro. Even a top Jewish ally said it could be heard as open season on Jews, given historical context, plus his past support for BDS.
The boycott, divestment, sanctions movement against Israel.
And his calls for Netanyahu's arrest. All that was baggage coming into the meeting.
So how did he address it with the CEOs?
According to Time, there was a subtle but pointed evolution in his language. He said he would discourage the use of the phrase, citing conversations with Jewish leaders.
Discourage, not condemn outright. Still nuanced.
Still nuanced, yes. But a shift. It suggests maybe a pragmatic flexibility, recognizing the weight of the mayor's office. He stressed his job would be to deliver for New Yorkers. Take care of New Yorkers, all New Yorkers.
Prioritizing governance and unity over sticking to a precise activist line, perhaps. Adapting his messaging.
Seems like it. And then there's a less explosive but maybe equally revealing example of this pragmatism. The World Cup.
New York is hosting next summer, right?
Right. And Mamdani is apparently genuinely excited about the economic potential. He sees it as a chance to use infrastructure development for virtuous growth jobs, long-term benefits.
Okay, focusing on economic development.
Yeah, and the article draws parallels to Mayor Bloomberg's push for the 2012 Olympics. And get this, Mamdani actually name-checked Bloomberg's former deputy mayor, Dan Doktoroff, who was known for being very business-friendly.
That is interesting. Name-checking a Bloomberg deputy, that signals something.
Definitely signals a willingness to learn from past administrations, even ones from a totally different political viewpoint.
So, connecting these dots, his handling of the Intifada phrase, his enthusiasm for the World Cup's economic side, these look like clear signals of an evolving approach to governing.
Moving towards the center? Or just being practical?
Maybe more practical. It shows he's willing to engage the business community, adopt pragmatic strategies. It aligns him with what Time calls this sort of nascent abundance movement among some Democrats.
What's the abundance movement?
Think of it as a group within the party focused on solving big problems, housing, climate change, not just through regulation or saying no, but by actively building more stuff, cutting red tape for development, investing in infrastructure, using tech to foster growth.
So a more solution-oriented, maybe less purely oppositional approach.
Exactly. Mamdani embracing the World Cup's potential suggests he sees himself in that vein. And he explicitly voiced this concern that democracy isn't just under attack from that outside.
But from within.
Yeah, from a withering faith on the inside of its ability to deliver on real material challenges for working people. So this practical turn seems rooted in that philosophy. To restore faith, government has to actually deliver tangible results.
But even with this don't worry tour, some National Democrats, well, they're still worried. A lot.
The reassurance didn't land everywhere.
Apparently not. The concern Time highlights is that Mamdani's win, his very presence, just underscores the party's leftward shift in big cities. And that gives Republicans ammunition for the 2026 midterms. Easy ammo.
Painting the whole party with the same brush.
Exactly. They quote Long Island Representative Laura Gillen saying flat out, a socialist is not the face of the Democratic Party. That really lays bare the divisions within the party.
It really does. And it tees up that huge question for the Democrats. Is Mamdani's victory a blueprint for where the party should go? Or is it just a New York City specific thing, an anomaly?
What do you think?
Well, the irony, as Time points out, is that his campaign focused on affordability, using podcasts, very digitally savvy, is exactly the kind of thing some Democrats were calling for after 2024 to reconnect with voters, especially younger ones.
So imitate the style, but not the substance.
That's the critical distinction, isn't it? Will the party try to emulate his actual ideology, move further left, or will they just borrow his toolkit, the campaign tactics, the communication style, without adopting the full progressive platform?
His performance as mayor will be watched very closely then.
Intensely. It's a real test case. Can this brand of progressive politics actually govern effectively and win broader support? The answer will have huge implications for the party's future.
Okay, let's talk specifics. His big policy promises, these are the things that will really define his mayorality. First, that rent freeze for a million regulated units.
How feasible is that?
Well, the mayor controls the board that sets increases the rent guidelines board.
Yeah.
And former Mayor de Blasio did impose freezes three times. So there's precedent. It's possible.
But there are downsides, right? Concerns.
Big ones. Housing experts like Vicky Bin at NYU worry about the impact on building quality. If landlords can't cover rising maintenance costs with rent increases, especially in older buildings,
they might cut back on upkeep.
That's the fear, leading to worse conditions, maybe even landlords walking away over time. Even de Blasio said freezes are doable, but need evaluating each year unto itself.
And Mamdani wants a four-year freeze.
That's the pledge. But he also talks about helping landlords in other ways, like cutting their water bills, trying to offset those costs. So he acknowledges the issue, seems to be looking for ways to make it work.
It's a classic policy tightrope, balancing tenant relief with maintaining the housing stock.
Exactly. Then there's universal child care, starting at 6 weeks old. Huge promise.
And hugely expensive, presumably.
The estimate Time gives is $5 billion to $7 billion a year. Significant money.
Wow. Can the city even afford that?
Well, what's interesting here is that this idea actually has broader support. Governor Kathy Hochul, a moderate Democrat, is also interested in childcare expansion. And NYC led the way with universal pre-K under de Blasio. Mayor Adams is also doing a childcare pilot.
So there's some political momentum and precedent.
Seems like it. Mamdani himself sounds ready to negotiate on the rollout. He acknowledges real questions of phasing in and stages, maybe not doing it all at once.
But he's firm on the end goal.
Absolutely. He insists those phasing questions shouldn't be used as a means by which to avoid reaching the milestone. So pragmatic on how to get there, but sticking firm on the what. Affordable childcare for everyone. It seemed like he knows this is a massive job he's stepping into.
The article suggests he's preparing intensively.
Yeah, reaching out everywhere, talking to former Mayor Bloomberg, getting advice from former NYPD chiefs, consulting with a really wide range of people.
Like who?
State Democratic Party leader Jay Jacobs, who apparently found Mamdani anxious to work with everyone. Figures like Lina Khan, progressive former FTC chair, and also looking to other mayors, like Boston's Michelle Wu.
Who he calls an inspiration.
Right, especially on things like free public transit. So he's casting a wide net for advice.
That's revealing. What does that tell you about his potential leadership style?
Well, it suggests maybe a more open-minded, pragmatic approach than some might expect. Willing to learn from allies, former rivals, people with different backgrounds.
Drawing on diverse expertise to solve problems, not just sticking to a narrow ideological lane.
Seems that way. But the article also touches on the personal adjustment. It must be jarring.
Losing your anonymity overnight.
Yeah. He admits, I already miss being outside. Says he goes to cemeteries between meetings because they are parks without people. That's quite poignant.
A stark reflection of the change.
Yet, he still seems driven to connect directly. That final image in the timepiece, him on the Uptown R train.
Surrounded by well-wishers, but also seeing the raw reality of the city.
Yeah, a woman passed out on the sidewalk. The competing food stands, a security guard yelling, I voted for you. It's all right there.
And that image really encapsulates the politics he seems to want, doesn't it? One that is in person, that is in public, that is with people.
Engaging directly with the messy, vibrant reality of New York.
Yeah, exactly.
So when you boil it all down, what's the big takeaway here? What does it all mean?
I think it means Mamdani's mayorality, if it happens, is much more than just about governing New York City. It's really a profound test case.
A test of what?
A test of whether this kind of direct, people-focused politics, born out of activism, amplified by social media, can actually restore people's faith that government can deliver for them, especially for working-class people.
And that's not just a New York question.
No, it resonates everywhere. It challenges a lot of conventional wisdom about who can lead and how you build political power today.
And there you have it, our deep dive into Time Magazine's September 8th, 2025 issue, focused on Zoran Mamdani's really remarkable rise.
It's quite a journey.
It is. We've looked at his unique campaign, the big policy hurdles ahead, his, you know, evolving and often pragmatic style. Going deep like this really helps you see the nuances, right? He's not a simple figure.
Not at all. And his story, as we've discussed, touches on these much larger questions about leadership in the 21st century, about where the Democratic Party is heading, about democracy itself in this fast-changing media world.
It's like a live case study unfolding.
Exactly. Challenging assumptions, highlighting these powerful forces reshaping politics right now. It shows who leads and how they lead is really in flux.
So the final thought maybe is this. As Zoran Mamdani gets ready to potentially lead America's largest city, his story forces us to ask not just what kind of leader is emerging now.
But what kind of leadership do our complex cities, our whole political system actually need right now?
And are the old rules of politics being rewritten for good? Something to think about. Thanks for joining us on The Deep Dive.
We'll see you next time.